Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokesman.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, sometime feminist film commentator.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, that show that is seldom speechless, especially about the art form that we all love, which of course is cinema. Sometimes, though, we encounter films that are so, well, out there, that at least initially, we are struck dumb. That happened to one or two or maybe even all three of us last week as we took in a pair of films by award-winning writer-directors that challenged the very essence of our critical faculties. The first is Megalopolis, the curious concoction of images and ideas that, so go the reports, have been percolating in Francis Ford Coppola's mind for decades. The second is The Substance, a film that took the most recent Cannes Film Festival by storm, winning writer-director Coralie Farja a Best Screenplay Award, despite its similarity to the Grand Guignol School of Theater. But more on that later. First, let's head to a world that is full of sci-fi illusions, social commentary, political chicanery, and so much more. Too much more, actually, and yet not enough. The plot that Coppola came up with is based on an idea, as he explained to IndieWire, that he first dreamed up in the 1980s. And it's basically simple. A visionary municipal designer, played by Adam Driver, wants to improve New York City by removing slums and creating a city of the future. In his path are the mayor, played by Giancarlo Esposito, a kind of influencer-slash-broadcast journalist, played by Aubrey Plaza, and a resentful, nefarious cousin, played by Shia LaBeouf. With everything playing out like a summer stock version of Julius Caesar, some of the dialogue is actually in Latin, Coppola portrays the struggle as the kind of elite versus the regular people, referred to more than once as mongrels, that we see played out in contemporary headline news. Only he does it in a way that feels almost as if he decided to make things up as he went along. The result is an overly long, 2 hours and 18 minutes, frenetically paced and edited, unevenly acted by a cast that includes a bevy of Oscar-winning and or nominated actors, and essentially an unintelligible mess of a film coming from a man who, at age 85, clearly is a long way from the artist responsible for some of the best films to come out of the 1970s.
Well, and it just so happens that the week I saw Megalopolis, I also saw the new 4K restoration of Coppola's film, The Conversation, in its 50th anniversary re-release. So I've just been having a Coppola kind of year. And earlier this year, I read a book called The Path to Paradise by the journalist Sam Wasson, which is about Francis Ford Coppola, but specifically about him making Apocalypse Now. And he was talking about Megalopolis on the set of Apocalypse Now. Like, people remember him coming up with these ideas about what would eventually become this film. So he's been sitting on this one for a long time.
Yeah.
And if you go to Wikipedia or if you've looked at any of the trade publications, this thing has one of the most checkered histories, I think, of any film that eventually did make it to the big screen. And I hope that eventually it gets a Hearts of Darkness style documentary about its making, because it's as troublesome and strange as the journey that the character in Megalopolis takes to eventually build this utopian society that he has in his mind. And I sort of understand all of the criticisms that have been leveled at this movie, because it is wildly unfocused. It is so overstuffed, but also feels like big chunks of it have been taken out. There are plot lines that develop near the end of the movie where you think, where did this come from? And then they get wrapped up within a couple of minutes. It's so strange. And yet I really responded to just the insanity of this film. And because this is not a normal movie, I don't really have normal feelings about it, or I can't really approach it with a normal critical faculty, because it's such a singular thing. Not only right now in, you know, the current state of auteur-driven films being what they are, but just in the body of work of Coppola himself, because, I don't know, it's such an odd duck. And I, even though it's a huge part of Megalopolis, I kind of dismiss the political stuff that's going on in this movie, because I mean, you want to talk about unfocused. It's the most unfocused part of the movie. And by the way, it isn't New York City. It's New Rome.
Yeah,
and just that
right.
Idea that, oh boy, America has a lot of parallels with ancient Rome. You know, that's not really that fresh of an observation.
Really?
To me, the thing that makes Megalopolis interesting and ultimately for me endearing, even though I see all of its massive flaws. I think this is one of the most personal films that Coppola has ever made, not just in terms of the personal money he's put into it, but this is a movie
$120 million,
he sold a fraction of, you know, the Coppola winery. To me, this is a movie about the delusion of creation, and it's about this idea of all of the things that you have to put into a work as you're making it. And there's so many parallels to Coppola's own life and work in the Adam Driver character, Cesar, but also in the character played by Giancarlo Esposito, who is named Francis in the movie. I don't think that that's a coincidence. Who's almost like the studio head overseeing this unruly director. And so I don't know. I could never recommend this movie to anybody in good conscience, but I sat there kind of in awe of it. I couldn't believe what I was looking at. I scoffed at it in a couple of places, actually in a lot of places, because it's very ridiculous.
We laughed out loud.
Probably not in the way that Francis intended. But there were also images in this movie that made me almost gasp because they were so beautiful and strange. And so, I don't know. There's something about this movie that I find very special, even though I am aware that Megalopolis is a capital F folly. And I understand all of the negative reviews.
Rather than capital F failure?
I mean, it could be that too.
He took a big swing here, but I think it's way outdated. That's how I felt about it. I think when he conjured this up in his mind, maybe 40 plus years ago, almost 50 years ago now, it might have had more relevance. So if you think of this film coming into being during the Reagan era, the early Reagan era, I think it would have made a lot more sense, because now it's just like, yeah. I mean, we can see the parallels. We can understand what maybe is the underlying motivation for Coppola's making this film. But yeah, it just falls flat. So if we want to continue with our F our F review.
Some alliteration
right,
going
exactly.
On here.
Yeah. And the acting is just so strange. I mean, I thought that, I mean, Natalie Emanuel, I'm not really familiar with her, but she plays the mayor's daughter, Julia, who also falls in love with Cesar. And of course she does. And I couldn't figure out if she was just a horrible actress or if they hadn't given her anything to do because.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I don't know how you can differentiate that between two Oscar winners, John Voight and Dustin Hoffman, who are basically wasted in this film. I mean, there is one scene in which John Voight, he's in bed and he pulls out a little baby arrow and starts shooting people with it. And it's like, what is going on here?
And that wraps up conveniently two plot lines
exactly.
at one time.
Yeah. And then we have Adam Driver doing the entire to be or not to be soliloquy. I mean, he does the whole thing and it keeps going on. It's like, we get the point. I mean,
and he has this little Caesar haircut, which
did not work. Yeah.
Then there's this whole like fabric or building material, Megalon, that supposedly has the ability to morph with the characters, or if it's used as building material, it will morph with the occupants of the building and so forth.
And Adam Driver has the ability to stop time. We haven't mentioned
yes.
that.
Yes,
oh,
yes, yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, and he does that very effectively while perched on these like grand steel girders up in the sky.
Yeah. Another beautiful image, I thought.
Yeah, that's right. He can do that until he can't, because right. at one point he loses that power.
Well, okay, but I want to go back because the Megalopolis defender has logged in, and that's me. The thing that was really moving to me about that whole concept of stopping time, even though I agree that Coppola, I mean, he loses a bunch of threads and picks them up again at random times or never picks them up again. Like, I acknowledge all of that. This is not a screenplay I would study to learn how to write screenplays. Let's just put it that way. That whole idea of stopping time, though, I think is the central idea of the movie, because at the center of this film, and the guy behind the camera can relate to this, mm-hmm. it's about a guy who has this drive, this mammoth, enormous vision to complete this project. And he feels like the only way he's ever going to complete it is if he literally stops time. And he can't come to terms with the fact that time is running out on him. Mm-hmm. And certainly it can't be lost on Coppola that that's his story too. That before he died, he had to get this movie out there. Whether it was ready, or not, whether it was past its prime, whether it meant anything anymore at all. And I don't know.
It meant
I find
something
that really,
to him, and but that's very
and I find
solipsistic.
That really moving. That's okay. Art can be solipsistic and interesting at the same time. Mm. What's wrong? You haven't loved narcissistic art before? Like, come on. Most
no,
art is.
We have. But I think here, part of the problem is, too, you expect that there would be some comeuppance for these characters who were these megalomaniacs and controlling everyone. And that doesn't really happen either. And so if there were some sort of story there, that doesn't even quite come to fruition. So I would just like to say that, yes, there are some intriguing aspects to this film.
Well, there has to be because it is Francis Ford Coppola.
It's a big swing that ultimately misses. So we just want to, unless you're Nathan's bestie, we just want to warn every other human in the world that maybe you would hesitate before you devote almost 2.5 hours to this.
Yeah, particularly as we saw it in IMAX because, boy, I'll tell you, my daughter left after 25 minutes. She just went, I can't take this anymore. So at any rate, that was our discussion of Megalopolis. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcast and Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to discuss The Substance. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed Francis Ford Coppola's latest and likely last film, Megalopolis. Let's now turn to a movie that gives new meaning to the term overkill. And I mean that both literally and figuratively. First, though, let me refer to a term that I used at the beginning of the show, Grand Guignol. It refers to a Paris theater that opened in 1897 and until its closure 7 decades later specialized in over-the-top horror productions. It's now used as a descriptor for everything from Italian giallo films to the bloodiest of Eli Roth's work. And it applies as well to The Substance, a film written and directed by the French-born filmmaker Coralie Farjah. Demi Moore stars as Elizabeth Sparkle, a one-time Oscar winner who has been reduced, a la the Jane Fonda of a few years ago, to earning a living by starring in an exercise show. Enticed to take a mysterious product called The Substance, which promises to change her life, she evolves into, if that's the right term, gives birth to might be more accurate, another whole self, played by Margaret Qualley, known only as Sue. And when Sue becomes a hit, thanks to the absurdly excitable efforts of the TV producer played by the absurdly excitable Dennis Quaid, the stage is set for a battle of wills between Elizabeth and Sue. And this occurs even though Elizabeth is told from the beginning that they are not separate entities, that they are one. So The Substance become a tale of sexism, of how that sexism leads to women having love-hate relationships with their own bodies, of women struggling for the kind of power traditionally denied them, all told within the Grand Guignol nightmare style featuring lots of nudity, buckets of blood, and so many over-the-top sequences, think The Elephant Man meets Invasion of the Body Snatchers, that you're likely to leave the theater shaking your head in dire confusion.
So I'm supposed to comment on this film, but Dan, I don't really know if I can say much more than you've already told us here. First of all, I think many trigger warnings are necessary for this particular film, The Substance. First of all, if you have any fear of needles, you will see them many, often in different sizes and diameters and
shoved
so forth.
In every orifice
right.
imaginable.
Right, and so please keep in mind that, you know, that's one trigger warning. I think the other is, I mean, this is a body horror film. And so people who appreciate that genre are going to probably appreciate this in ways that others might not, because it is way over the top and it just keeps on rolling out in various forms and incarnations and so forth. And I think that this film was working for me for a while, but then it just got to be like, can you hit me over the head with this concept yet one more time? Maybe, I mean, it has an over 2 hour run length. And so I think The Substance has a point to make, but then it just went too far. Now, the last 20 or 25 minutes of the film really are a total gore fest. And so we were laughing through most of that. And so that's the body horror genre that I think attracts some people, or maybe there's something else going on I don't understand. But Demi Moore's performance, I think, was very notable. Margaret Qualley didn't have a whole lot to do, but her character is sort of subject to the classic male gaze, and it's all like titillation and tweaking and everything. And these characters, the two women that are one entity, they don't really interact with one another. You know, their paths cross because they have to trade places every 7 days. But in terms of their really having any sort of course of dealing with one another, they're almost like echoes of what that might have looked like if the story had taken another direction. So I think this is way over the top. There were things about it that I liked, but it is gory. And I think everyone needs to understand that fully. So, Nathan, I know this is kind of your jam, so go for it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree with the idea that the substance really only has kind of one point to make, and it makes it over and over and over again. I agree that the middle section of this movie, I understand what you're saying. It gets a little repetitious. The idea that it goes too far, I also agree, but I thought that was kind of part of the fun of it. I saw this movie as a film about a woman who is objectified to such a degree that she literally becomes like an object and falls to pieces, literally and figuratively. And there's this wonderful shot at the beginning of The Substance where it's kind of like a God's eye shot of Elizabeth Sparkle's star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
Oh, yeah, that's a nice
scene.
And we see
like
that time lapse happen as her career also kind of falls apart. And then the return to that shot at the end is quite funny and disgusting and absurd and sad all at the same time. And I really like the casting of Demi Moore. I think it's very canny because not only have we not really seen her do this kind of work before, but it's impossible to ignore. We talked about the parallels in Megalopolis. It's impossible to ignore the parallels between her real career and how she's been treated in the media and this character. I always like it when a movie kind of has that doubling going on.
Well, yeah, because then Margaret Qualley is, you know, Andie MacDowell's daughter. Mm-hmm. And Andie MacDowell and Demi Moore came sort of age at the same time.
Yep.
So there was that parallel construction as well.
And there's also, I always kind of like these little Easter eggs, but sometimes it does sort of feel like you're just giving us an Easter egg to give us one. There are lots of references to other movies in The Substance. I mean, there's a literal music cue from Vertigo at a very funny point, I have to admit. There are long corridors and bathrooms that look just like the Overlook Hotel in The Shining. Yeah. I was thinking of all the movies of David Cronenberg, Stuart Gordon, Seconds by John Frankenheimer.
Dennis Quaid's character's name is Harvey. I mean, does that
as
hit
in
us
Weinstein,
over the head? Yes,
right?
Yeah.
And I also like the way that Fargeot films him. He's always way too close to the camera. He's leering. It's such a cartoonish, buffoonish performance. But I haven't seen Dennis Quaid give it his all in this way in a while.
Right.
So.
It was supposed to be Ray Liotta.
Yeah. I read about that.
Ooh, that would have been.
But
Dennis Quaid was a really good fit. He's just so disgusting. And,
yes,
and I think he sets
that.
The tone for the disgusting stuff we see later on in The Substance.
And there was one really poignant part of this film. So Elizabeth Sparkle, the Demi Moore character in The Substance, is not like a real person. I mean, she's this celebrity. And so we can relate to that too, given our celebrity culture today. But at one point, she meets an old classmate and he wants to get together with her. And so
he's a quote unquote average looking
guy. Like nerdy,
he
sort
looks
of
like
high school
Stephen
guy.
Tobolowsky in Groundhog Day.
Yeah.
Right. And so
Ned Ryerson.
She agrees, albeit reluctantly, to get together with him. And then she, as she's preparing for their date, their outing, she just sort of falls apart, and we can see that happen visually. You know, she can't live up to her own beauty ideals that have been, of course, dictated by the culture at large. And even though this guy wanted to connect with her, it appears as though he had a crush on her. And so she's afraid about disappointing him, disappointing herself. And I thought that whole sequence really worked well. Yeah, I thought that did too. Yeah.
I think that of all the movies that we've reviewed over the years, though, you know, people every once in a while will hear a commentary, you didn't prepare us for the violence, or you didn't prepare us for whatever's going on. We got to let people know this is one of the bloodiest, full of nudity. Mary Pat uses the term trigger warning. Boy, I'll tell you what, if you're sensitive to any of this stuff, stay away from this.
It makes me think, back in the day when NC-17 became a thing and they thought, this is a rating for something that is more extreme than your typical R-rated movie. If a movie like this can't get an NC-17, they're just not going to use that rating anymore because it's basically at that level. Yeah. And this has started happening too, is these kind of quote unquote weird horror movies come out and the internet freaks out about them. Long Legs was a recent one that we reviewed and people are talking about how weird it is. And then we go and see it and I'm like, it's not really that weird.
I know. Like,
I've seen really weird. And I thought that about The Substance until about, as you mentioned, about the 2 hour mark when it goes nuts. And I said, this is really weird. And it reminded me of the final scenes in Carrie, but times 10.
The one thing I wanted to deal with before we've got to cut this out is this is getting a 90% Rotten Tomatoes rating by critics.
But a 70% by viewers.
Well, yeah, but how can we rationalize that? Why are we so different from 90% of the critics who love this film?
Well, I really like it too. What are you talking about?
Oh, man.
Yeah,
did you
I was
not like it?
No,
yes.
I was in
like
the middle. Right, no. I was in the middle. I mean, because I liked parts of it a lot.
Wait a second. Sitting here having a conversation about a movie that
it's
liked.
It's disgusting, and I couldn't stand
it. The point of the movie is it's supposed to make you feel, you like the work of David Cronenberg, don't you?
Yeah,
Dead Ringers. 15
or 20 minutes into The Substance, I was thinking, wow, there's a kind of a feeling of David Lynch here. But David Lynch makes movies that are weird, offbeat, and mysterious. There is nothing mysterious about The Substance.
No, it's an allegory. It's the picture of Dorian Gray meets Videodrome.
It's as if Eli Roth tried to make a serious movie.
Eli Roth could never make a movie this good.
Oh, no.
Well, you know what, Eli? I'll give you some credit. Maybe you could. But I like The Substance a lot. But I agree, that comes with an asterisk. It's for sickos only.
Yeah. And that was our discussion of The Substance. This is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and early in the show, Nathan Weinbender, Murray Pat Truthart, and I discuss Francis Ford Coppola's Megalopolis. Let's take this moment to thank Cassia Fox for both producing and engineering the show. We thank you to our loyal listeners, and we invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best, and sometimes the worst, that cinema has to offer, wherever we can find it. Until then, consider these words from none other than Stephen King. We make up horrors to help us cope with the real ones. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.